Time for another local hero spotlight with Jennifer Kaur from CESA, the local hero folks, and we are at a farm without a farm. Windrow Farm, which is like a farm amidst all the other farms.
The farm of the wind.
Because Jay Silverman from Windrow Farm has hay fever.
Yeah, hay fever indeed. I mean, I say how my farm is just sort of it's a verb and an entity, but just exists all over Conway, scattered around a bunch of different hay fields that different people own. Yeah, it is always funny when people say they want to visit my farm, and it's like, I don't know where the circus is going to be that day. So let's try to plan ahead and figure out a barn or field or something like that.
And I think of all the farmers we've talked to, we've never talked to somebody who just does hay.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying it that way, too, because it's some people will say, oh, just hay, and it's like, oh, gosh, there is so much that goes into this. And my brain is never not working, and there's this whole kind of really nerdy corner of farming that's really common in New England, especially Western Mass, and especially these hill towns where we have these hilly, rocky soils that produce really good grass and really good hay crops. Been a nerd about hay since I can remember.
Can I provide a little context?
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Just because I think it matters when we're talking about hay. So if you think about the world, right, there's just only so much land on the planet, and then within that, it's like a quarter of the total surface. There's only a fraction that is like agricultural land, maybe an eighth of that quarter. And then of that, only a third of that is like arable, so prime agricultural land. Mm-hmm. The rest of that is marginal agricultural land, and that's where hay and forage grows best. So this is a great example. We came up from the Connecticut River Valley, up in elevation, away. So we're like in this space where exactly hay is the crop.
Absolutely. I mean, we grow good rocks and trees up here, but the grass grows really well in well-managed fields. And most of the fields here that are being hayed are really not well-suited for a lot of other kinds of ag. It helps the landowners keep the land open and sequesters carbon and does a whole bunch of nerdy things I could certainly talk about.
Get into it.
Yeah, we want to talk about it.
Don't skimp on the science.
All right, don't
skimp
on the science.
That's why we're here.
Cool. So, you know, grass does this amazing thing of thriving under disturbance. So when grass is grazed or mowed in this system that I'm doing at least a couple times a year with good fertility added back to it, it outcompetes other weed species and other plants. And in doing so, when it's grazed or mowed, it sheds carbon into the soil, and so it can actually be a carbon sink when it's done in a no-till system. And I'd say of all the fields that I'm haying, only one has seen a plow probably in the last, I'm guessing, 30 to 50 years or more. So it's really this perennial cropping system of grass that is capturing carbon and sequestering it in the soil and improving soil health and then feeding animals that really rely on it in the food and fiber system around here.
Is the grass just regular grass like people would have in their yards? If they let it go, it would turn into something they could use as hay, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. It's interesting. In different parts of the country, or if you get more like into the valley, places where people more routinely replant hay stands, you know, they can get really particular about different varieties of grass. You've got orchard grass and timothy and perennial rye and all of these things that maybe people have heard of or not heard of. But around here, that was done at some point with these fields, but then a good, just healthy mix of the types of grass that grow well there have thrived. I do have a couple fields that used to be lawns, and whatever was planted there did grow up, and often that's a much kind of finer, hard-to-identify type of grass, but often works well for certain animals. But then other fields are just so many different microclimates. Like, I've got it on spreadsheets about different compositions in different fields and trying to match that up with people's animal needs and texture and nutrition and all of that. So it was not really a yes or no answer, but it's kind of all of the above around here.
So most of the grasses in New England are cool season grasses,
yeah.
So they have a flush in the spring and
right.
Then again in the fall.
Yep.
And those are grasses that were imported from Europe during colonization.
Yeah.
I'm curious if you have been experimenting with like warm season grasses or
right.
more native grasses as we're seeing these like droughts and higher heat temps.
Yeah, I mean, I have not reseeded any of the fields that I'm haying. They've all been fields I've taken over from other hay farmers. It's this whole hay field succession thing that's happening as people age out of hay and not as many younger folks are getting into it. But I haven't, you know, reseeded or replanted any fields. It's really a matter of managing what's already there and improving that quality through fertility. And some of these fields I've been haying for a decade or more and just watch that quality come back. So they are mostly cool season grasses. There are a lot of native grasses mixed into it. Those ones can be a little bit harder to identify because they're not some of the major grasses that everybody recognizes. But yeah, I've been hearing more about, you know, as the climate shifts and this all gets more complicated, trying to experiment with some of those more warm season grasses. But it's interesting, with a cool season, you actually need rain in that cool season. So this year has been interesting because the yields have been down so far in first cut, and I don't think that's going to change at all. Yeah, as the climate shifts, this just all gets more unpredictable and gets really difficult, let alone growing the grass, but also drying the hay, because I do all dry hay. It's entirely weather dependent. And trying to predict that in these increasingly swingy years gets really challenging.
Can you talk to us about why you're doing dry hay?
Also, the difference between wet and dry hay, yeah. because I think people see like hay and straw as one thing and don't think about its original state or why you might use its original state.
Absolutely. And then there's even another nerdy nuance about small square bales versus round bales.
Yep.
So I'm doing all squares, the traditional ones that you move by hand.
Thumbs up from Jennifer Core.
Why? Is there something wrong with the round bales?
No, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, so, okay, let me back up to answer that first question about dry versus wet, because that's a really important thing. I mean, traditionally, hay was dried to store it into the winter for use by animals when there's no fresh grass to eat. That's still what the majority of it's used for. And it was dried in order to keep it from molding or even spontaneously combusting if it's not dried enough, which is always a risk. So people figured out over a long time that they needed to dry it down and essentially preserve it that way.
Like the jerky of the animal feed.
Yeah.
Right. Kale chip. It's like the kale chip.
Oh, kale chip. Okay.
There you go. But the kind of technology of making silage and fermenting grass, mostly for use by dairy cows or other ruminants, has gotten more popular. And especially as the climate keeps shifting and it's harder and harder to have these stretches of weather that you need to make dry hay, dairies and beef farms and other producers like that have been able to either chop that grass and ferment it either in silos or in plastic-covered pits or the marshmallow bales that people see, the plastic
wrapped. I love that. I used to tell my kids, this is a marshmallow farm, kids.
Right, exactly. That can work as a really efficient feed source for people that are feeding their own animals, but it can be difficult to market that to a lot of the smaller-scale homesteaders, small-scale farms, and horse owners, because horses really can't eat that fermented hay. Being a hay farmer that's selling all of my hay to local folks, making dry hay really is where the market is. It's also what I love doing, and the entry point of the equipment is cheaper than trying to get a round baler and then wrapped round bales. But also the market is really for these dry, small squares. Say small. They used to just be called squares, and then out west they started making big squares, and now we have to call them small squares. But hand scale.
They make everything bigger out west. They have the space to do that.
So, you know, I still have equipment that I'm using. Most of it's like this 50-year-old tractor behind me and 50-year-old baler. I have a couple new things. I started out with 9 acres, and it would be having friends and family meet me in the field to pick up 50 or 100 bales out of the field by hand onto trailers, and now I have a bale thrower, which is what got me hooked on hay at the age of 2 anyway. So I've got wagons behind the baler and doing hopefully 500 or 600 in a day.
So you got into farming because you could throw things.
Well, have any of you ever seen a bale thrower on the back of a baler? I mean, my 2-year-old brain just latched onto that. My parents, neither of them were from Conway. They bought a house just by the library. I came along, and a good friend who's become a hay mentor was the one that was haying that field back then, and my 2-year-old brain saw it and saw these bales flying into the wagon, and it just clicked. And I've never been able to put into words exactly why I love hay so much, but it all goes back to that. It's a total Rube Goldberg machine. And now that I have one and am able to do that, I don't know, I just get a bit of joy every single time it throws a bale. I just can't really explain it.
I love that.
Do you have to hire labor at all to load into the barn or otherwise?
Friends and family that I insist on paying, but really it's just a good network of people helping, and then sort of over time increasing efficiency of the fields that I'm doing, the different barns that I'm using. One that I started renting this year that I can park a lot more wagons in, and then I have customers meet me to get a lot of it off wagon. So I haven't really had to get into the employee realm. It's kind of the sweet spot of this being a viable part-time livelihood, that trying to scale that into the full-time realm is really difficult. And so part of that is trying to figure out how much I can do myself and with friends and family that help. My wife is a school nurse and is off for the summer, so she's able to help a lot. My dad helps quite a bit, and I have other friends around that are just lovely people that are really enthusiastic to help.
But your other job is also farm-related, and you worked with a farm who was on the show in Clarksburg with Many Forks Farm in trying to get their farm under agricultural preservation. What's your other non-hay-related farm job?
Yeah, I was really excited to hear that connection. So I'm also the Massachusetts field agent with Land for Good. So we're a nonprofit. We work in all 6 New England states, and we work on farmland access, tenure, and transfer. So we're really helping farmers find land, how to get on that land, how to write written leases that reflect reality well and function well in real life, working with landowners trying to find farmers, and then a lot with succession planning. So people that are looking toward the next generation of their farm and how to pass it on to people they know, and or even if they have nobody who's interested, how to find somebody. So I've been doing that work for the better part of a decade also, which is just a lot of fun and really meaningful and just taps into all my interest and experience doing this, because like I said, all the hay fields that I hay are not owned by me. They're all different arrangements with different landowners, and it's this really kind of mutual system for it.
I will just add that Jay is actually really good at this work. Everyone at Land for Good is, but you are really good at this work.
Oh, thanks.
You have some hay baled over here.
I do.
We've got your old tractor right here that I'm going to walk by, and then we can go see some wagons with like baled hay.
Where are
are you drying your hay?
In the field, sun and wind dried hay. So it's a matter of trying to find ideally a good 3-day window around here to do it, where there's no rain in the forecast. Trying to make dry hay, especially in New England, especially in the era of climate change, it just, to me, is like the nerdiest strategy game ever. I mean, if you're a logistics nerd, hay is actually a pretty decent thing to try to exercise your brain that way, because there's just so many little variables that all add up. And just trying to get the hay dried down enough that you can bale it without it molding. I mentioned before the spontaneous combustion risk. A lot of people don't know about that, but if hay is too green, like if the cells are still respiring, and you bale it and you pack it all into a bale and then you pack all of those bales together, it goes through this wild cycle of microbes and anaerobic bacteria that increase the internal temperature of that haystack. And then,
have you ever had one spontaneously combust?
Not even close. I have, you know, every now and then, if there's some that I'm worried about and I set them aside, I have felt a couple of warm bales in my day. It's really freaky to feel that happening. But, you know, over centuries, people have lost barns. I mean, it's just, and especially before the things like moisture meters to test the moisture content and some of the science and understanding of why it was happening, you know, people would have loose hay in their barn in the 1800s and go pull out a pitchfork, and then this flush of oxygen would come in, and it's just wild. So that puts on a lot of stress when you're making hay for four people to put in their barns, and then you're using and renting other people's barns to store it. You don't ever rush it to the point where something like that might happen. But over the years, you do figure out like where the line is and what you can sort of get away with, but also just really, truly trying to make thoroughly sun and wind cured hay the natural way, I guess.
Hence the kale chip analogy.
Yeah, exactly.
The alternative being the real pickles, like lacto-fermented dill, right, which would be your, like, haylage.
Yeah, or especially you get into New York and Pennsylvania, applying preservatives to hay has gotten more common, too. You know, as the climate shifts, I understand that as a technology. It's one I'm really resistant to use.
Do you feel like there's more appeal around here, especially because, like, there's no preservatives or any outside treatment done to your...
Yeah. That's really interesting. I've been trying to parse that out and talking to my customers, but just sort of trying to suss that out. Do people actively not want that around here? And it's hard to present it in a way that's not a leading question. But I think you are right. I think that, you know, in this area, there is kind of that preference for things that don't have that kind of treatment to it.
Can you talk a little bit about how you're managing fertility?
Yeah. So fertility is the only non-organic practice that I do. So I am using conventional fertilizer. It's really important when you're doing hay, especially if you're selling it, to be putting stuff back into the soil when you're taking the hay off, because otherwise you're exporting the fertility from the field. Sorry. Getting out of breath for a second.
We are going up a big hill in Conway.
Conway is mostly hills.
Yeah.
We are going. There's
Festival
no
of the Hills.
It's the hayland, the hills.
It is. So, you know, I'm applying fertilizer to make sure that the fertility in the field stays strong, but without having a ready manure source from that, it means I need to use conventional fertilizer. So I do that based on soil tests, tap into my bit of my education from UMass doing sustainable food and farming there, and just try to figure out what each field really needs and then apply it. So that's actually what I'll be doing later today.
Jay Silverman, why do you call your landless farm windrow farm?
Oh, yeah. So windrows of hay are kind of the iconic look of a hayfield when it's all been raked into rows prior to baling. My wife actually gets credit for coming up with that name.
Uh-huh.
I've just always loved the look of a raked hayfield. So raked is when it's all in rows prior to baling. And the idea of putting it in a windrow is really that kind of final drying step of getting that last bit of moisture out of it, getting it collected up off the ground, letting the wind blow through it, and then having it all ready to go in the baler. The baler follows the windrows as you bale a field.
So these are your wagons.
Yeah, yep. Here's a couple empty wagons here. And then, so this is one of the main barns that I'm using this year. I'm actually renting it from a good friend of mine that retired from hay after last year. And so I picked up some of the fields, some of the barns.
You might have said this already, Jay. I apologize. But how many total acres are you?
Sure. Yeah, so I'm haying 70 acres this year, scattered all over Conway. So it's like 20-something different fields, most owned all by different people, but people that are really supportive of that. And also they benefit from the land management and the mowing of it, too. So, but it's very much not all in one spot. It's very much of like a traveling circus kind of model.
Yeah.
I love, Jay, first of all, this has nothing to do with hay, but that you're wearing a Star Wars shirt, and then whatever this is has a This Is the Way Mandalorian sticker on it. Is that, what is this piece of equipment?
So this is the baler. Thank you for noticing that. Not many people do. But yeah, I'm such a nerd of all kinds. Star Wars and hay kind of go hand in hand for me.
Hay Solo.
Exactly.
You stuck-up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder. Who's scruffy looking?
You're a hay farmer, not a dirt farmer.
Yeah,
or a moisture farmer.
But I was going into Toshi Station to pick up some power converters.
An anti-moisture farmer? Just the right amount of moisture farmer. Anyway, so yeah, this is the hay baler. This is actually kind of the pride and joy of the whole operation. I mean, it really is, it's a Rube Goldberg machine. It takes the windrows of hay and packs it into a bale, and this particular one has that thrower on the back that shoots them all into these various wagons. I've got six of them now that trail behind.
And this giant barn in the back, stacked floor to ceiling with rectangular bales of hay. Yeah. Small bales,
very
I now
nice,
know.
Very nice hay.
Oh, like,
really? Jennifer Kaur feeds animals. Do you use hay to feed your animals sometimes?
We sometimes, yes. Every New Englander needs hay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
I think we gave some of your animals some hay.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, we went there and did some chores.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And that is a good segue of the fact that hay is such an important input in the food and fiber system. I don't know, I run up against that with the Land for Good work that I do with certain landowners, or just sort of this mentality that hay is something else other than food production. It's so meaningful to be providing it as an input for people that are doing food and fiber and draft power. I'm lucky enough to make all the hay for Natural Roots, the horse-powered farm.
Yeah, and they run on horses.
Yeah, and so...
Horses run on hay.
Exactly.
Hay is for horses, better for cows. People don't eat it because they don't know how.
And they can't. That's actually an important thing to say. Yeah. These hay fields are growing plant material to feed livestock, who then turn that into protein for us. And that is a really important part of the system.
Absolutely. It's really meaningful to plug into that. I've had times of trading hay for cheese for small-scale goat dairies. So it is a really vibrant piece of local food and farming and fiber, and then especially like we talked about with land types and soil types and what different things are well suited for. It's just a really efficient system to be growing on some of this land and soil and topography that's more difficult for other types of farming.
So forage and haymaking is like the largest kind of agricultural land use across the state.
Wow.
Yeah, so we think of protecting farmland. In many ways, we're talking about protecting forage land.
Which is funny because we've talked to so many farmers, but like I said before, never somebody who does just hay. But we should theoretically, with percentages, be talking almost only to hay farmers, given how the breakdown of how land it's worked out.
We always hear about farms that have extra land that they're haying.
Yeah.
We always make kind of assumptions about, like, well, that's going to livestock somewhere, somehow. The intermediate process is the thing that we haven't really looked at.
And some farmers do their own haying.
Right.
And you're just doing... So does it work economically for you? Like somebody says, come get this grass out of my field? Or do you have to buy the grass and then sell the hay?
So up here in the hills, it's really all free lease on the hay fields.
Yeah.
It's folks that own anywhere from half an acre up to maybe 5 or 6. Or I guess I have one field that's 13, which is wild. But these houses and properties that have these fields, they either were hayed very recently or they hadn't been hayed for a while, but they're faced with the cost of needing to mow that if they want to keep it open. There's current use tax benefits they can get for having that land farmed. If it's over 5 acres, there's a whole nerdy corner that I could get into. But it's basically one of the few true win-wins still out there, where landowners are really enthusiastic to have their land hayed. I'm enthusiastic to come in and do it, so long as topography and location and all of that makes sense. And so I'm able to hay it essentially for free, but I'm the one that puts the fertility inputs in and then take the hay off, and they get their land managed and mowed and the fertility improved and all of that out of it.
Yeah, I do think it's important to note that haying is like a capital-intensive endeavor. It's not just kind of like, oh, there's grass and let's go get it.
There's free grass to go sell,
yeah, there's
right?
really intense sort of like machinery costs, the facilities to store your crop over time, the inputs to the field.
The fear of spontaneous combustion, which is now a new fear that I can live with.
We hear about people leasing land all the time, but not so much leasing barns. How hard is it for you to acquire barn space to store the hay in the meantime?
That can be a real challenge. I'm really lucky to be, I mean, I'm a first generation townie in Conway, but everybody's known me as the hay nut since I was 2. And so I know people and farmers, and there's certain hay fields that also the landowner has a barn, and it's been a conversation of saying like, oh gosh, I'd love to hay that field. I need a place to put the hay though. Could I use part of the barn? And that can be really difficult for folks. I'm really lucky to have a network of different barns around town that I'm able to use and kind of piece that together.
Can you walk us through your baler? Just because these are very persnickety.
We won't fit, Jennifer Kaur.
This is the way.
Okay, great. So, so first, a tractor is attached to it. This drawbar swung out that way, so the baler is offset to the side of the tractor as you're baling. You're following a windrow, so one of the rows would be going right in the pickup here. As it's running, it's all powered off this drive shaft, which is like the most amazing piece of it. Just this is spinning, and there's gears and different timing pieces, so the hay is going in here. These packer forks push it that way. And then for any of you that have ever heard a hay baler out in the field, it has this very rhythmic sound to it. And that rhythm is this big plunger in here that's pushing the hay back that way. Every beat of that rhythm is grabbing another chunk of hay and squishing it together. If you want to go around that side, I can show you the nutter because it's wild. But it basically is measuring the length of each bale, and when it gets to the right length, it trips this mechanism, and these two arms go up through the hay, tie a knot, come back down, all in between those plunger strokes, and then bales come out the back. And so long as the knotter's working right, which legend has it, somebody had a dream in like the early 1900s, woke up, built a prototype, and it essentially hasn't changed since.
It's a magical functionality.
It really is.
And, like, and that's what ties it all up.
Yeah, yep, and it's, you have to have that adjusted really well. I mean, I don't take a lot of credit for how well this baler works. I try to keep up with it, but it's just a really good design from the 70s. This one I added a bale thrower on, which is these two fast-spinning belts that shoot each bale into the wagon, and aside from it just being what I love about hay the most, and it's a lot of fun, the efficiency piece is huge because it, instead of saying, hey, I've got a few hundred bales in the field, come meet me out here, we all need to pick them up and then go to the barn, I can just say, hey, I've got, you know, six wagons ready to unload or to just pull them and park them undercover like the ones you see here and deal with them another day.
I kind of want to go back to the agroecological value of hay fields, just this idea that it's twofold value in habitat and also in terms of like soil health. And if you want to talk us through carbon sequestration a little bit.
Grass, every time it's mowed, sheds carbon into the soil. It sheds root mass. It's basically, if you're thinking about the grass plant, it had a lot of material above ground doing photosynthesis and a lot of roots underground. And then it gets grazed by something, or in this case, mechanically grazed. And suddenly it has a lot less above ground material. It needs to shed some of that root mass because it's trying to hold on to too much of itself that it's trying to feed without enough green above ground to photosynthesize. So every time it's cut, it's shedding root mass into the soil, and that's building carbon over time and actually building soil. And so in these hayfield systems that have not seen a plow, and I mean, again, I don't think I'm exaggerating by saying half a century or more, you just have this really rich organic matter that's been building fertility and capturing carbon and all of that. So despite the fact that I'm using tractors with internal combustion engines on them, at least for now, you know, it's doing a lot for the carbon game that way too.
Do you know how many varieties of plants are in your hayfields?
That's a really good question.
And I imagine that it varies from field. It must vary from field to field.
And it even varies like within the same field in some of them too. So it's that part can get a little bit tricky, like where one corner of the field dries faster than another. And boy, trying to pick a number is interesting because there's kind of a few main categories. There's some of the main grasses that everybody knows that I keep track of just from my own knowledge and from a marketing perspective. So like orchard grass and timothy, perennial rye is one of my all-time favorites because it dries down so nicely. Actually, I think that bale might be some of that. And then there's other, again, these like native grasses that are really hard to get an ID on and really ebb and flow throughout the different fields. Then you have some amount of weed pressure that of non-noxious weeds, so weeds that are not a problem for livestock but are just kind of there. They water it down a little bit. You know, I don't spray any herbicides or anything, and that's less common in this area. You get to other parts of the country and people will kind of spray herbicides on bigger hay fields to try to get like a pure stand of timothy or something like that. And then there's a few noxious weeds to be on the lookout for. I think the main one people are struggling with around here is horse nettle. It's actually a nightshade. It's these little yellow berries on this nettle-y type plant that really pops up after you take first cut off. Because there's, I didn't even say, there's
like
a couple.
No competition!
Yeah, exactly. They're just like waiting, and then they pop up. And those in a high enough quantity can be poisonous for livestock. And so for that, there's this whole game of trying to keep track of, luckily, only a couple of fields that it's in and a few edges and bale that separately and only sell it to people that fully know what it is at a discount and that whole communication game. It's really diverse. I mean, it's really a whole ecosystem that's going on.
Are you having the bed straw pressure?
Yeah, a bit. You know, there's always some amount of bed straw in certain fields. It's this really low-growing plant with these tiny white flowers, and they call it bed straw because it grows really well right along with the grass, ends up in the hay bale. The animals really don't eat it, and so it's sort of left over after they eat the hay, and a lot of people use it for bedding. That can be linked to acidity a bit as far as having good enough pH in your field, so adding lime to try to bring that pH back up. But overall, because it's not a noxious weed and because it's in low enough quantities, at least around here, people expect and understand a certain amount of that. And I think, you know, a lot of the customer base I deal with, they're valuing the no spray side of it more than like saying the hay has zero kinds of weeds of any kind in it.
How many of your customers are horse customers?
Yeah, numbers.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, I certainly have a good...
capitalist society, we always want quantitative data.
I mean, I spend all winter spreadsheet farming, so yeah, I'm in that realm too. No, I've got quite a few horse customers. Folks that live right in town or in nearby towns, a couple of friends that actually come up from Connecticut to get some hay. A lot of that tends to be first cutting, which is bigger in volume, lower in nutrition. I often say first cut's kind of like lettuce and second cut's kind of like spinach as far as like nutritional density. It's all the same plants, but first cut is when you see all the seed heads coming up. So a lot of these hay fields, especially ones that we haven't gotten to yet, it almost looks a little bit like wheat or something where you can see all the seed heads on it. You mow it once, and then what comes up after that is really high quality, lower yielding second cut, which is all the leaves, and it's where all of the protein and sugar, I shouldn't say all of, it's a lot higher in protein and sugar and other nutrients that like ruminants. So people doing sheep and goats Or folks with horses that have teeth problems that need softer material. That's, you know, what they tend to go for. Natural Roots is actually a big user of the first cut that they make off of their own fields. It's like the timing of that. They have their draft horses come to the field and fetch the kicker wagons as I'm bailing. It's just like this beautiful moment of seeing horsepower bringing the hay back to the barn. You can tell the horses get excited about it. They know exactly what's happening.
How I feel when I go to the Northfield Creamy.
That exact energy.
I just want to point out the second cutting thing, that tender grass.
Yep.
So that's what you see when you're on the highway. And like all of a sudden we have a lot of deer pressure right next to the highway. It's because they mow and now there's like the tender growth. So those deer do not want to be hanging out next to the highway, but it's really good
food. Where the good food is.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Problems of our own making.
Yeah.
Have you found in your adjacent farm life that your story of like how you work hay fields is inspiring to the people coming into agriculture? Because like you're going about this in a way that people don't necessarily know about around here. And it can be kind of enlightening to both like the people who are trying to move off of their farms or like give their farms away and the people who are trying to come into agriculture that it doesn't necessarily have to just be zucchini.
Yeah.
That could be a bumper sticker, but anyway.
No, I think so. I mean, certainly there's a big history of people doing hay in a very similar way to this. But I do think this idea of owning none of that land and none of that infrastructure, you know, is a little bit less common and I think is encouraging to folks. I mean, at least in the way that I'm happy to nerd out about it with my Land for Good hat on with people and encourage that. I don't know if it counts as outside the box thinking, but just this idea of...
Inside the bale.
Yeah, probably. There you go.
Not the baler.
No, there's spikes there. We don't fit. We had this talk. Do you know anybody else who's doing hay in the area? Not necessarily like you, but like just in general, because like, again, like you're our first hay farmer.
There are a lot of people doing hay around. Yeah, it's anywhere from folks that are getting into it or a lot of people that are making it for, say, beef cows or other kind of smaller intermediate scale farms that they have going on. A lot of former dairies that have retired from dairying are continuing to make hay. So it is a really popular venture around here. It's just not super well known.
Part of the impetus for people to keep their land open is that this is what we all love about living in this area. And most of that landscape is shaped by open forage fields.
Yeah. And it gets to your habitat point, too, that a lot of these open fields would not be here if they weren't being farmed or hayed in some capacity. I mean, New England was forested, and that it trends back in that direction, unfortunately, with a lot of invasives, the way that succession of forest land goes these days. But, yeah, a lot of that habitat wouldn't be there if we weren't haying and farming it, as much as it's an imperfect way of, imperfect from some of the wildlife's perspective, depending when we mow the field. It's never perfect in that regard, timing-wise, you know, they're being...
Ground
nesting birds.
Yeah. We learned from David Sibley about the bobolinks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Try to wait till July.
Bobolinks, yeah.
Yeah. And that part's so tough, and it's such a heart-wrenching push-pull on that. But, you know, from a hay farming perspective, like, we can't wait till July to do it all. I mean, the forage quality is not there, and you lose quality of the fields, and there's just no way to get to all of it, too. So it's sort of...
You got to make hay while the sun shines.
Exactly.
Interestingly, though, I think the science is sort of pointing to the fact that you can graze through fields, and ground nesting birds do survive. There's still nest success with that.
Jay Silverman, Windrow Farm. Thanks so much for being the first strictly hay farmer that we've talked to. I've learned so much about hay. I can see why you love it so much.
Well, thanks for coming, and I'm always happy to share the nerdy corners of hay production.
I hate to bail on this conversation.
No, not at all.
But hey.
Wheels are turning.
Hey! I feel like you've been sitting on that one.
I have that.
Yeah, waiting. Yeah.